Hello everyone, welcome to a new season of The Kernel of Truth. I'm your host Rupa, and today we have two guests, Russ, who needs no introduction, and Pete Lumbus, who's going to play the host and a guest, two parts. So Russ, can you introduce yourself to our guests?
Sure, I'm Russ White. Let's see, I'm about 30 years in the networking industry now, something like that. So I'm a lot older than I look, which is a good thing, I guess. So right now I'm working at Juniper Networks, mostly focused on data center fabric type stuff, but I also am involved in FR routing and several other open source thingies and the ITF, and I write some books and I don't know, whatever. People can find me if they want to look.
Yeah, I run technical marketing here at Cumulus. I've been here for about 5 years now. You know, one thing, you know, Russ and I have done a couple of recordings. We've crossed paths through a couple of different jobs. But I always like to bring up that Russ is like my great-grand mentor, I think it is. When I was at Cisco, my mentor, Rodney Dunn, I believe his mentor, or maybe another removed, was Russ.
Oh, I worked a lot with Rodney, actually, in the global escalation team. And in Cisco TAC. Yep. Taking cases.
Small industry.
Small world. Yep. It actually really is a very small industry. Yep, it is.
Yeah, especially networking. Yeah, everybody knows everybody for some reason. Okay, so today's podcast, we'll be discussing routing protocols in the DC fabric. And Russ has been recently involved in a lot of optimizing distributed flooding and so on. So we'll talk a little bit about that, open fabric, Rift, and so on, and whatever, wherever you guys want to take the conversation. To start with, I think Russ, and we were just talking, and Russ had this note about autonomous and automatable. How do you pronounce it?
Automatable.
Yeah, there you go. Protocols. So I thought that was very interesting to start with. We at Cumulus, we have been constantly trying to make routing protocols easier to automate with simplified configuration and so on. Pete can go on about this, like auto BGP and so on. So I'm interested in your views about that and what's happening in that area today.
Yeah, so I think that right now we're very focused on automatable protocols. And I was just talking to, in automation in general, I was talking to Greg Farrow about this week as well. And it seems to me that if we're actually going to make progress, we eventually need to figure out how to move to autonomic, which is the protocol just figures out how to run on its own as much as possible. The network needs to run on its own as much as possible. Now, of course, when I say this, I don't mean let's get rid of automation, right? Because that would be crazy. No, the thing to me is that if you really look at network complexity, you don't really get rid of network complexity. You can throw it across the cubicle wall and give it to somebody else, but you can't just get rid of it. It doesn't exist. There's just no way to not have complexity. Complexity is just a natural reaction to hard problems. So what you can do instead of trying to get rid of it is you can try to contain it and figure out where it's best to put that complexity. And so when I look at my world, you know, as a network engineer, and I think about it, like I do hierarchical network design. The reason I do that is because I'm constraining complexity in certain places in the network. This is the same concept. It's not that you want to get rid of an automation system. It's that you don't necessarily want the full complexity of managing a control plane in the automation system, right? When I look at it, I kind of want to think, where can I take complexity out of the automation system and put it into the protocol? Where does it make sense and where doesn't it? And try to figure out those types of things so that I can understand a little bit, or I can actually move the complexity around in a way that makes more sense from a network operations perspective. So that's kind of my perspective on autonomic and automatable, is that, you know, you can make something automatable, but making it autonomic is perhaps a different thing. So what do you think?
I was just going to say, without diving into, protocol design discussions, but to get to what you're getting at with autonomic, I mean, that's the whole value, quote unquote, of something like EOGRP or OSPF, right? I turn it on, I put it on all the interfaces, and just like it does its thing until it doesn't, right? Is that kind of what you're getting at?
Yep, that's right. Yeah. And, you know, we're trying to move BGP closer to that, right? With some of the stuff that has been going on with just various working groups in the ITF and stuff in FR routing and vendor stuff. And I just think that at some point you may be pushing BGP over the edge when you try to make it too autonomic, because it's actually designed not to be autonomic, right? It's actually designed the opposite way, whereas ISIS, OSPF, and EIGRP are designed to be as close to autonomic as possible. So this is where you get into like which routing protocol should you use on a data center fabric. But I think, you know, I think that just thinking in those terms and trying to understand where am I putting my complexity and what am I doing with it, helps as a network designer and as a protocol person as well to do the right thing.
And when I look at, you know, the protocol design and some of the things coming out, like whether it's trying to understand the motivations for older protocols or, you know, the knobs that they have, or looking at some of the new stuff coming out with like Open Fabric and Rift, you know, it always seems to be a question of simplicity of protocol against topology, right? So I can make it extremely, extremely simple to where anybody can drive it, but it only works on one fixed topology, or it can work on any topology that any person can ever imagine, but then all of a sudden you have a kitchen sink worth of features. Is that accurate?
Yeah. Oh, I think that's accurate. I think that's very accurate. And I think that's a major problem we run into with these types of, when you look at somebody like Facebook or Google or whoever, they develop their own routing protocol. A lot of times it's not because what is out there on the market won't support what they want to do, but it's because of the self-driving problem, right? You've got to have somebody who can drive that protocol in a very large scale, complex environment. When the network itself is really complex, the last thing you want is a really complex routing protocol. You're driving on top of a complex network, right? So you go design your own. And it's not so much because the commercial product isn't good. Sure, it's good, but it's good, but it solves a million people's problems. And therefore it's very complex. So you're kind of in that position.
And so one thing I've seen a lot, you know, I've had a lot of these conversations with customers about, you know, even the really simple one of OSPF versus BGP, right? OSPF, again, gives us that kind of automatic, it just works. BGP is, you know, look, there's some design guides. It's the thing that everybody's doing. So maybe we should jump on the bandwagon. And for me, it always comes back to every enterprise, especially in the enterprise, is going to build in an exception. Right. No matter how hard they try, something's going to come along and they're going to be like, yep, this fax machine can't be connected to two switches in the same rack because of electromagnetic interference when Mars is in retrograde. Like, there's always something. And so when you think about that within broader scale, like if I'm not Google or I'm not Facebook, like, what are your thoughts on how do you make that autonomic?
Yeah. So I think the way you do that is you start by layering your control planes and separating out your domains, your failure domains, and your complexity domains very, very carefully. And you try to contain those unique things in a layer or in a section rather than just like you would with a hierarchical network design, right? You start in hierarchy and you say, well, all of my branch sites that are 10 devices or less are the same. So I just make that cookie cutter, right? So I just stick all that in a bin and it's done. Well, then I have this other branch site that's 20. Well, that's not going to fit in the cookie cutter. Okay, so I leave that as an exception. But I don't make all my branch sites unique because I have one or two that actually are unique, right? I actually think through what is unique and what isn't. So when you get to something like an IP fabric in a data center, well, IP fabric's an IP fabric, right? It's just going to transport IP. That's all it wants to do. So can I make that underlay control plane and that data center fabric design very consistent among all my data centers and use best common practices for that while then constraining somehow that uniqueness into an overlay or something like of that nature? So I can actually divide out the complex parts, or even in a particular VLAN or a particular pod or whatever you want to do. But just think through, what can I actually divide out and not have it interfere with what is common is kind of the way I look at it.
Yeah. And I think when you look at well-designed networks, that ends up being the common factor is that ability to isolate and compartmentalize. And I think one thing, you know, it's easy to talk about, say, an underlay protocol versus an overlay protocol and separating them out and putting complexity here and there. But I think one thing that gets overlooked sometimes is just throwing money at the problem. And it doesn't mean millions, but like, look, just buy two more switches and like carve off this this fancy thing that's doing something custom. I talked to somebody last week and they're trying to do MPLS traffic engineering end-to-end in their data center because not all of their WAN routers have the same connectivity outbound. And so they want to be able to push how traffic gets to the WAN router all the way down to the leaf switch, you know, at the top of rack. And my point to them was like, that's ridiculous. You're pushing all of this complexity across the whole fabric because you're not willing to just connect those three devices together. Like, run some extra cables, figure it out, and like, let like compartmentalize all that complexity physically within that component.
Right. So I'll give you a perfect example of that. It's not data center related, but it's very, very old. It used to be when you were running large-scale hub-and-spoke networks over frame relay. Oh, my. Nobody's going to remember what frame relay is.
Hey, it was on my CCIE. It was the only time I've ever used it.
Yeah. So we used to run these large-scale hub-and-spoke networks using frame relay, and they would be 2,000 or 3,000 sites, or even larger sometimes. I mean, really huge. And we'd run them into like a pair of 7500s or 7200 Cisco boxes. And what we would find is before EIGRP had the stub functionality that the query range could not be contained in so that you didn't hit all the spokes with the queries, right? Because you just, the query range in EIGRP is one hop beyond the aggregation point or the filter point. So if you only had two routers that were in your hub and spoke, then you had no place to filter where it wouldn't allow, or it wouldn't propagate those queries down to the spokes. So what we would do is we would actually buy two more routers and put them in front of the hub and spoke routers, right? Just throw hardware at the problem. No, I can't solve the problem protocol wise, but I can solve the problem with two new routers. And yeah, it's expensive and you got to maintain them and everything else, but does it make your hub and spoke network at that scale stable? Yes, it does. So fine, problem solved, right? So I think that's absolutely true. Now, the downside of that is I will say that you can end up building a network full of one-offs, solving everything that way. And then you end up with a unique snowflake in which, again, you get back to the no part of the network is consistent enough to automate or to make autonomic or whatever you want to do with it, right? So that's always a fair balance.
Either or both.
Exactly.
I think we've definitely seen BGP become kind of a common, I don't want to call it a de facto standard yet, but a common deployment model for DC fabrics. What else are you seeing? And, you know, I think there's the 1% extremely large, but if we think about the 99%, what else are you seeing out there?
Well, right now, everybody is still looking at BGP, even down to the smallest of scales. I think there's a push on to open up other opportunities. I don't want to say necessarily displace BGP per se, but to open up other opportunities for various reasons, particularly in the area of making it autonomic. There are people that are getting concerned about the complexity of BGP as a protocol, right? I mean, I'm one of those people, honestly. When I first started at Cisco, the entire routing protocol stack was 40,000 lines of code. And so I would do code reviews across all four protocols. And the people who are coding the protocols were like, how do you know all four protocol stacks? Well, I know all four protocols and it's only 10,000 lines of code. I mean, it's like, it's nothing, right? You can know 10,000 to 40,000 lines of code. But nowadays, and I remember when Cisco IOS hit the million lines of code mark. I remember very well the day that the email went out and said, latest compiles a million lines of code. And it was like, whoa, that's crazy. I bet you there are BGP implementations that are 100,000 lines of code, 200,000 lines of code at this point. So at what point do we keep pushing the protocol and adding stuff to it that you start worrying about the stability of the protocol itself? So I think that's one of the reasons people are saying, hey, whoa, 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 slow down. Let's think about what we're actually doing here. Do we actually want to do this? Do we want to split the protocol? How do we want to solve this problem? And is BGP really the right answer? The other thing is, I think that telemetry and just the ability to do traffic engineering stuff is starting to become a bigger deal in data center fabrics. And just the ability to take an ISIS or OSPF LSDB and just take the entire link state database and grab it periodically and be able to play back the state of the network is such a huge deal that people don't think about. So I think there are some players who are starting to think about that kind of stuff, mid and large scale, who are starting to think about that stuff and think about, could we do it this way? Now, at a truly huge scale, you're never going to get away from BGP. You might be able to run a link state protocol in some part of your network, right? Like at a pod level or at a fabric level, and then you connect your multiple fabrics with BGP or something. But you know, scale is relative, so that's, you know, that's going to depend on what you consider big scale or not.
You know, that I think you bring a couple of interesting questions to mind for me. I think one, when you talk about, you know, BGP kind of continuing to grow, you know, I know you live in the southeast of the U.S. You know, it's a little bit like kudzu, just kind of, it just goes everywhere. But do you have any concerns when we look at new protocols and the loss of lessons learned? I mean, I know we've seen this even in like the reimagining of BGP and other, you know, there's a Rust BGP, there's Go BGP, and then all of a sudden you see them hit problems and you're like, yep, solve that one 10 years ago. That's why I don't rewrite from scratch. What are your, do you have thoughts or concerns around that and some of these new protocols that are coming up, or is it new enough that some of those learnings don't matter as much?
No, I think those learnings do matter actually a lot. And so this is where you get into different philosophies about how to solve this problem. So for instance, Rift is largely a brand new protocol. I'm not saying that's wrong, but there are, you know, you're going to hit issues when you run it at scale of lessons learned. That's just the way it's going to be. Whereas something like Distop Flood or even some of those types of things where you're just optimizing the flooding of ISIS or OSPF, or even Tony Lee's set of drafts around centralized flooding. It's not really centralized flooding. I call it that, but it's not really. It's centralized calculation of flooding trees. You can get into something that you're already, you're not modifying it as much, right? So you're trying to capitalize on those lessons learned without modifying them too much, kind of. So those are kind of different philosophies around it. Now, some people might be really comfortable with the new protocol. I mean, Facebook invented OpenR, right? They're perfectly happy with that. Great. I know that other companies have written their own BGP stacks and they're happy with that. Great. Awesome. But I do think there's something to be said for the lessons learned and stuff like that that you go back onto.
So is OpenR deployed outside of Facebook or is just within Facebook?
As far as I know, OpenR is only deployed inside Facebook, and it's really kind of a limited deployment on top of that.
Yeah, I think one of the big challenges that even if you can find a protocol suite that would support it, where do you run that protocol suite? I think that becomes a challenge that most organizations run into, is they're like, even if I wanted to be able to compile it and run it, I don't have a 48 port device that can drop this protocol onto.
Right.
So, I was just going to change gears a little bit and go back to, you know, you also talked about the value of telemetry and getting that link state database. Just to make sure that everybody's on the same page, when we're talking about that, the value there is that within an LSDB OSPF area, for example, I can just get it from one device, right? And every device has the exact same set of information, so it doesn't matter who I get it from. Versus if I would be able to get the same type of information from BGP, but I would have to get it from literally every single node. Is that accurate?
Right. Yep, and not only that, but the way the LSDB is formed is designed to run SPF. The way the LSDB is built internally is designed to run SPF. Whereas with BGP, you would have to go through and say, who are my neighbors? Who's connected where? You would have to actually build that in your code somehow to build that out. Whereas with OSPF and ISIS, you can go to the FR routing implementation of ISIS, for instance, grab the SPF code, just the SPF code as your example. You know, if you're just going to run SPF trees across it or constrained SPF, and you already have working code, it's done, right? It's just like, it's battle tested. It works. It's fine. Go use it. So that I think is actually a much bigger deal than people realize when you're running at scale or large scale.
At what scale does the whole local LSDB or having LSDB at every node breaks apart, right? What is the scale at which this makes sense?
So I have a mental map that's different than other people. So you have to take my mental map of scale to be, you know, with a grain of salt. It's Russ's mental map of scale and not anybody else's. So in my mind, I'm pretty comfortable with a single flooding domain of a link state protocol up to 2,600 to 3,000 routers or nodes, and up to 120 to 250,000 routes. Now, I think if you get much bigger than that, you really want to try something like Rift, or you want to try just run BGP, right? And that's just experience. I don't know for certain that those numbers are real. Like, well, I know that we can go at least that large. Could they go larger? I don't know. I have no idea. But just from prior experience, I mean, I've seen single flooding domains with 4,000 or 5,000 routers in them, but they didn't have the route count. And I've seen single flooding domains with 2,500 routers with 120, 200,000 routes in them, so or reachable destinations. So I'm pretty comfortable with those kinds of numbers. Now, if you're going to try to go larger than that, then I would be a little bit, you know, like that's maybe not a good idea. But so I don't know. I mean, I think you could take BGP all the way down as well. I mean, obviously you can take BGP all the way down to, you know, 200 or 300 routers or even 10 or 15 routers, because people do all the time. And even unmodified ISIS or unmodified OSPF, you know, you could probably be pretty comfortable around the 500 to 600 router range in a single flooding domain. I wouldn't be too. There's ways of knowing that you run into. If your SPF runtime goes too high and stuff like that, then you kind of know you're in trouble.
There's definitely some, you know, religious holy wars go on. even here internally at Cumulus, you know, I end up living in the if all I have is a BGP hammer, everything looks like a nail. You know, that's what I'm guilty of. But it also is one of those things where I'm like, yeah, you know, the only thing worse than running BGP on 10 routers is getting to the point where you have to modify from OSPF to BGP and trying to do that transition live and blow anything up.
Yeah. Well, the other thing I would always look at is, what are you comfortable with as a NOC? And what are your automation pools built for, right? I mean, if you're running 5 data centers on BGP and your automation and your NOC guys know BGP, then there's not necessarily any real good reason to switch. If I'm greenfielding and I happen to run my core in ISIS anyway, well, why not consider ISIS, right? I think that's the beauty of having the options.
And, you know, you've mentioned Open Fabric, you've mentioned Rift a couple of times. You know, if we look at the value of that LSDB, you talk about, like we mentioned at the top of the show, the ability to kind of get that autonomous capability out of a link state protocol like that. I mean, what was the motivation for looking at the new protocols like Open Fabric and Rift then?
Yeah. So Open Fabric is the older version of Distop Flood. If you want to look up the draft name, we're currently calling them Distop Flood. And the big thing with Distop Flood that I was looking at was just trying to do minimal, absolutely minimal to no on the wire changes to ISIS and make it work up to a reasonable scale. And the reason I kind of picked on ISIS was multiple things. It was, first of all, ISIS is TLV based, which is really, really nice because you can do lots of stuff in TLVs that are much harder to do with OSPF. I don't have to invent a new LSA type to do what I want to do. Now, newer versions of OSPF are much better about this, but ISIS has been native that way since day one. The other thing I really like about ISIS is it's its own ether type. It doesn't run on IP. So I don't even need IP on my fabric at all, really, for initial configuration.
Like, I think half the listeners just turned the podcast off, but that's okay.
Yeah. To me, for initial configuration startup, it's not a big deal to run on link local like OSPF does, but just for me, or even BGP, just seems like to me for initial startup, it's just easier to run on the ether type and run straight on Ethernet instead of trying to mess around with IP. So that's kind of the genesis of Open Fabric and the Distop Flood set of drafts. Now, Rift is a little bit different. It does run on top of IP. But Tony, when he was designing Rift, Tony P., he's actually looking more at scale and particularly at fib scale and how many routes you can stick into a single router's fib. And for Open Fabric, I didn't really address that because I was thinking, you know, you can always do rib to fib compression. There's other ways of solving that problem. I don't necessarily want to put that complexity in the protocol. Again, just trying to make that, where do I stick the complexity trade-off type thing? Whereas Tony's very concerned about keeping my routing table on the top of rack down to about zero routes or one route or less than 8,000, essentially. So Tony basically built Rift. Tony's going to kill me if he hears me call it Rift. Anyway.
That's like a Freudian slip there.
So Tony basically built Rift around the ability to do route aggregation. So it does automatic disaggregation. It detects when there's link failures. It detects when there's miswirings. Now, actually, you can detect miswirings in IS to IS as well. That's not published anywhere, but there is a way to do it. I've been meaning to get it in the draft. I just have been lazy, if you can believe that. But anyway, yeah. So, you know, Tony was focusing on a different set of problems.
That's interesting. You know, I didn't actually know that there was kind of, you know, he was taking it from a rib perspective. You're looking a little bit more of a fib perspective or a control plane perspective. Are there implementations of either of these out there, you know, prototype or otherwise?
Yeah, actually, Rift, if you email Tony P, he can give you a containerized version of it. I don't think there's a publicly accessible. I'm not sure that there's one on Git. I'm not positive about that. But there are implementations of it. It's been tested. It seems to work fine. It converges like a scalded dog, from what I understand. But I haven't actually tested it myself. Desktop Float stuff, yes, it's available right now. Really, the only implementation that's available publicly is in FR routing. So it's a daemon called FabricD, and you can compile. There's a compile time switch on ISIS that converts it to FabricD, and you can bring it up on FR routing and try it. And it's been tested at scale, 2,500 routers and 120,000 routes.
And the concept of distributed optimization, flood optimization, is basically a hierarchical reflooder. Is that what it is?
Yeah. So actually, both Rift and Distop Flood do the same thing, in that they pick a set of neighbors' neighbors, and then they choose a subset of neighbors to flood to optimize the flooding. And this is not a new idea, by the way. This is something that was done for mobile ad hoc networks way back in the 80s and the 90s to optimize OSPF for a mobile ad hoc network running on top of basically point-to-point radio links in the field. So man packs and helicopter to ship communication and stuff like that. So this a lot of these concepts come out of those ranges of problem sets that were trying to be solved.
So if I like dramatically oversimplify that, the idea is that in a traditional link state database, every spine is going to get the same information and then reflood that information all the way back down, you know. So I'm basically going to get 10 copies, and this concept, the spines are going to do some black magic wizardry and just say, you know what, I'm going to be the one that floods to the set of leaves, so everybody only gets one or maybe two copies instead of 12 copies. Is that accurate?
That's right. Yep, that's accurate. In a three-stage CLOW, both Rift and Distop Flood use a mechanism that reduces the flood count from, so let's say you had 16 spines. Every leaf is going to get 16 copies of every LSDB or every LSA. Whereas with these modifications, they'll get precisely one copy. So makes a huge difference in the amount of time that it takes to do this. In a five-stage, like a butterfly, it can be a little messier. It's going to be a little messier just because of the way the fabric itself is set up. So you're still going to get a number of copies at each leaf, but it's going to be a lot less than it would normally be. So it's still a reduction. It's just not down to one necessarily.
And so, that, I mean, yeah. I think that's a great illustration again, where you know, you can only optimize for so much within a routing protocol, because you have, you know, this need to do some mathematical computation on routes against a physical topology constraint. And so you can optimize for one or the other or fall in the middle, but you can't perfect it on both.
Right. So this is where something like, and by the way, another difference between those two, between Distop Flood and Rift, is Rift really only works on CLO, butterfly, spine and leaf fabrics. It won't work on anything else. It's designed specifically for that topology.
So no, I'll never see, I'm not going to see Rift in my DMVPN hub and spoke.
No, No. And you're not going to see Rift in your Toroid or your Hyper, your Tesseract or any other odd topology, right?
Those whereas sounds like Dungeons and Dragons monsters.
Whereas Distop Flood will actually work on any topology. Because it's doing local calculation.
And so, you know, as you've gone through this, I mean, it sounds like you've worked with the Rift folks as well, you know, and talked to them. You know, what were their influences on kind of traditional hardware design or the systems themselves that drove decisions or made you make certain considerations?
Yeah, well, you know, Rift is designed to be a commercial product, right? So it's designed in a way that a vendor can sell it, because of course it was written by Tony P, and that's, you know, that's where it came from, and that's its heritage. So he's trying to make it much simpler, not need operating system customizations. Distop Flood and Open Fabric came out of LinkedIn, and so we had access to the operating system. So doing changes to the RIB to Fib interface in order to support stuff we wanted to support was just not as big of a deal. So yeah, there's hardware considerations that go into that as well.
So are these in deployment? Is Open Fabric in deployment anywhere? Maybe at LinkedIn or?
It's been tested at LinkedIn, but it hasn't been deployed. Rift, I don't think, has been deployed in production anyplace. They've both been tested at multiple places, but neither has been deployed.
Did Rift come out of Facebook as well? Sorry, I don't know.
No, it's fine. Tony P is Juniper.
Okay.
So, yeah, Rift comes out of Juniper mostly. But Cisco is looking at implementing it, and I don't know if there's an FR routing implementation in the works, but Cisco's definitely looking at implementing it, and some other folks are as well. And then you have the third one, which is Tony Lee's, which is what he's basically doing is he grabs an LSDB out of the flooding domain, and then he has a centralized device that calculates an optimal flooding tree. It doesn't actually flood, it just calculates an optimal flooding tree for the entire topology. And then you send that to everybody, and they use that in order to do their flooding. So it's kind of in between.
It's like OpenFlow 2.0.
Yeah, but it's not really even, I mean, it's just, right, it's just optimizing the flooding tree again, right? You're actually not changing the way ISIS floods. You're just setting your SRM bits to, when you get an LSP, you just don't set certain bits to reflood because you know you've been told not to in the topology, basically.
But even so that, you're still describing something that requires a controller from what I understand.
Yes, that's correct. Yes, that's correct. This requires a controller. So that's the downside there, right? So if you look at where Tony Lee comes from, which is Arista, their data center fabric design always includes a controller anyway. So they're just taking their design and optimizing around the same sorts of problems in a different way.
So beyond these protocol optimizations and algorithms, right, are there any implementation-specific optimizations in this area? I'm a systems person, so I was just curious if there is any different technology being used for LSDB or any of this.
Not really, because it's control plane level pretty much. It just seems like, you know, everybody's just trying to optimize the control plane, and they're not doing control a whole lot of anything else. Yeah. In fact, there's a lot of question about, are people even thinking about it at the systematic level? Unfortunately, we don't do a whole lot of that in our world.
I'm guessing that, you know, we've also, the evolution of memory and CPU and network devices has gone up a huge amount in the last couple of years. You know, I'm guessing we've already done a lot of the, like, heavy duty bin packing, how many LSPs in a packet optimally fit, and those kinds of things to allow protocol inventors now to not worry as much. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I would say that's accurate as well. In fact, it goes back to your whole thing of not losing lessons learned, is that so long as you're working with a link state protocol, you kind of know, if you built ISIS, what to look for, where link state's going to break someplace else if you build another link state protocol. So in some sense, these aren't completely new protocols like you might get with, I don't know. I've seen some places where people try to invent a completely new way of routing. In those cases, you're going to hit a lot more problems than you will if you are just doing something that you're starting with kind of a well-known technology.
So the FRR implementation of distributed flood optimization, is that an extension of ISIS, you said, or is it just a separate daemon? You mentioned a separate daemon, right?
Well, it's you compile ISIS with a flag, and it spits out...
Okay, got it.
It spits out Fabric-D instead of ISISD. So it shares about 99% of the code. There's just basically some ifdefs that, you know, allow certain code to compile instead of other code or in addition to other code.
Cool. So Russ, anything else? Pete, I was going to just ask Russ about to talk about his own podcast. Can you let our listeners know about it?
Oh yeah, sure. I actually have two podcasts. I'm podcast heavy. No.
Well, Russ. Sure. Podcast Big Boned.
Yeah. So the first podcast that I do is called History of Networking, which is just, so it's kind of this weird story. When Yakov Richter retired, who's one of the people who invented BGP, I realized that nobody was grabbing oral histories or anything of the people who invented this stuff that we use, right? So I started asking around and just trying to get people to come on. Well, we've gotten pretty close to 100 people to come on and talk oral history of what they built in the networking world. So including Vint Cerf and Dave Farber, who was Vint Cerf's, or one of the PhD advisors. He's called the grandfather of the internet. We've gotten Paul Makapetris, who invented DNS. We got Paul Vixie, who wrote the initial implementations of DNS. We even got the guy who wrote the code that turned into Cisco IOS. So it's been really cool getting those guys. And so that collection is still ongoing. It's released every other week or so. It's really released about 25 times a year or something like that. I think we do 50 or something.
I'm a regular listener. I would strongly recommend that one to anybody. There's some.
Yeah. It's called History of
Networking.
We'll put it in the show notes. History of Networking. Okay.
Yeah. Really fantastic. It's really interesting stuff.
Yeah. And it's available on iTunes and it's on Rule11.tech, and Ripe also cross-publishes it. And some other people have talked about cross-publishing, but they haven't yet. And then the other one is just my little personal podcast called The Hedge. And The Hedge is just, we just talk about general junk, whatever we want to talk about. And it's entertaining. I just had Andre on to talk about manners. And so it's everything from life to technology. It's kind of fun as well. But it's every week. But it can be everything from technology to just life in general. So, yeah. And I call it The Hedge because network engineers remind me of hedgehogs.
Does that have something to do with dirt baths?
No. Has something to do with curling up in a ball and hissing with your spine stuck out whenever somebody gets too close.
I resemble that remark.
Yeah, exactly. So,
what else are you currently involved in, Russ, beyond the drops?
Oh, all of this stuff. Yeah. So I'm still working on FR routing. Not as much as I should, but I am working on FR routing whenever I can. Getting some stuff done there and helping push PRs and helping with protocol questions, and then always in the IETF. I don't know. I'm co-chair of Babel, and I try to keep up with all of that work, which is hard. And then I have just work.
Great. Thanks a lot, Russ. And thanks, Pete. Thanks for listening to The Kernel of Truth. We'll be posting show notes on the Cumulus blog, where you can find loads of educational material on Cumulus and the open networking industry as a whole. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast if you haven't already, so you're notified when the next episode is posted, or follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. Thank you.